you and I had just a wonderful and fascinating conversation just a couple years ago, about what, a year and a half ago, maybe. Mm-hmm. I think we named that discussion Journalism in the Disinformation Age. Mm-hmm. And what a just fantastic overview that was. You gave us basically, you know, your working model that you've been developing around journalism. And as a journalist, you know, the opportunity for you to, you know, directly engage with and inform this model is amazing. And I had so much fun going through it with you last time we talked. Me too. We're here today to basically follow that up. Your model has expanded in all yes. sorts of really cool ways. And I really look forward to getting into it. And, you know, as you and I were talking about in the pre-show, I think, you know, the main frame that I'm bringing to this conversation, Stefan, is that it seems to me that what you're doing is you're really offering, the first example that I can think of an integral approach to media literacy itself. And by media literacy, which is, you know, so completely required in today's, you know, age that we live in the social media age that we live in, where it just seems like our capacity for critical thinking and for, you know, sourcing our perspectives and our opinions and being able to simply tell the difference between, you know, opinion and fact is really difficult. It's really challenging for a lot of people. So I think that the project that you're doing is so critically important, not just so that the audience can better understand what it is journalists are doing, or maybe sometimes how journalists are manipulating truths or realities in order to get, you know, certain ideologies through or what have you, but you're also, you know, basically creating a framework that allows journalists to better understand what they're doing and to better understand their audience and to better understand other journalists. So it's really, you know, it's taking media literacy and it's turning it into, you know, not just a one-way street, but sort of this grand intersection between journalist and audience and so forth. So I'm really, really fascinated to see what you've got to show us today. Before we start, is there anything you want to say to just sort of introduce what you've been working on since the last time we spoke?
So thanks very much for all the appreciation. And as I also said in the pre-show, so finally somebody is getting what I'm doing, because so I've been collecting so much data. So it's really like out of a control model. So yes, and I'm very happy to talk about it again. So thanks. Awesome.
Well, you know, we have our new platform, our new integral theory platform called Context, which allows people to make these maps and use artificial intelligence in order to create these. So I know what it's like to work on a sprawling map where it's like I start with a seed and it just sort of, you know, oh, there's a whole rabbit hole here. Okay, let's follow that rabbit hole 10 layers deep. And then here's another rabbit hole we can follow. So I definitely, you know, but I think one of the things that you're doing really, really well is you're taking a lot of complexity, but you're synthesizing that complexity in a way that is approachable, that is understandable, that basically allows people to get the gist of what it is you're trying to communicate, while also giving them the option to jump down any of those rabbit holes that they might find interesting or that they might find, you know, useful for whatever they're doing in the world. So, you know, kudos to that, man.
Thanks, man. Okay. Yeah. That's great. Yes, so maybe I just give you like a short of a brief introduction what I did in the last 1.5 years so that we have a base to talk on, and then just free float. So, okay, I can share my screen. So basically what I was doing in the last 1.5 years was to see like what's really the fundamental problem of journalism, since I'm a journalist. So I started from that perspective. And I quite fast found out that there are four layers of problems. So the first one would be the reporters themselves who are working in the newsroom. So my colleagues and a lot of my friends, and they are quite frustrated with the workload, with the bad payment, with the time-consuming workflows, and so on. Mm-hmm. And some are also, like, this was one thing that came up a lot, was that, so the journalists who are a little bit leaning more into the post-conventional, they are always telling they are frustrated that they feel they don't do justice to the complexity of the world. So that they would like to have more complexity in the stories, but it's they are cut off from the editors. They also don't have the skills, the tools for that. So this is like the reporter's side. Then you have the audience side, which basically, so one of the things I did was really an audience panel. So sending out questionnaires to people from all walks of life. And then like asking them a little bit about themselves and also a little bit about their opinions on journalism. And then I was actually scoring them with a like Washington sentence completion test, so the Lovinger model, to see if there are different needs or different expectations to journalism on different levels. And of course, there were a lot of different things, but there were three things that were in common. So on almost all the stages, which was lack of perspectives. So I don't feel represented because my perspective doesn't show up. And if it shows up, it's in a distorted way. Mm-hmm. The second thing was lack of empathy. So what I read, one thing was reading feels like work. So I'm reading the newspaper, but it's not fun because it's so cold and rational. And the other thing was it's too cynical. So I'm even repulsed by that. And the third thing was too much negativity, which is like, even in the mainstream media now, this is really a big thing, how to get out of this negativity bias, because that makes the audience feel powerless and then turn away from the media, so the news avoidance. So, and I mean, this showed up in all the stages, that the like the way they would frame it was different, but it was always these three things that seemed to be missing. So this seems to be like the core of the problem. So then there are the media companies who are worrying about retention nowadays, because now all the media are like Spotify, so you can like have a 1 month subscription and then you can go away again. So you need to find ways to keep the readers inside, so to increase the loyalty. And then there's a lot of hybrid competitors, so like John Oliver's or content creators that have like a quite well journalistic core in their work, all kinds of other things, influencers, well, more or less journalism inside, but still journalism in a way. And so the brands are somehow losing this this being the center of gravity. So it's more like, so they are not like always the what's the word, like not the gatekeeper, but like setting the tone, setting the like being the center of gravity of the discourse of society. So that's a little bit fading. And then the last like problem field is society at large. So I mean, you could summarize it with polarization, and one thing that is underneath it and which has to do with this negativity bias is that people are actually having a decreasing self-efficacy expectation. So which means that they're not even expecting anymore that they can change a lot in the world, and that somehow leads to polarization and sometimes even to like radicalization.
Of course it does.
So these are like the four layers. And then I was looking for solutions, and I found quite a lot of solutions, a lot of interesting. Yes. So a lot of media startups that are not having that much reach, but still are having interesting approaches. Just the problem about that was that it's like they're always focusing on individual aspects. So like singular problems in this big systemic problem, and then it's often combined with method absolutism. So it's like the cure for the whole journalism is constructive journalism, data journalism, whatever. And of course, that's not the cure for the whole thing. It's just a cure for some of the aspects of that problem. And so what was really missing, and this would be why I'm calling it integral journalism, is alignment. So that somehow like find what's really underneath, what's the fundamental systemic problem that like the root cause that we can maybe change. And so then that was the core question. So what does a holistic model looks like that it really advances journalism at all levels?
What comes to mind as I hear you talk is that, you know, the goal of so many, sort of the classic goal of journalism is to be this sort of neutral, objective observer, right?
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that you're actually leading to is sort of this paradox where you can only be neutral and objective if you have some degree of subjective alignment with whatever yes. the topic is that you are writing about or that you're reporting on. So yes. when you get people who are trying to, who have no access to the actual everyday experiences of someone who is impoverished and you know, maybe always has been impoverished, there's a different kind of mindset associated with that particular set of life conditions. And if you have a journalist who just simply cannot align or attune with those experiences and they try to be impartial and objective in their reporting, chances are there's a lot of things that their objectivity is missing because they don't have access in a certain kind of way to the interiors that they're actually trying to sort of report on. So, you know, in a way it's sort of like you can't have the objective kind of approach without the subjective attuning to the subject matter. Which feels, I don't know, kind of profound in a way.
Yes. Yeah, that was actually another workshop as well, which I called reality tunnel training, which is basically teaching about cognitive biases. I mean, there are like 200 cognitive biases, but there are some who are very, very present at journalism. And one would be the availability heuristic, which is really just people sitting in a room and just take what comes into their mind first and then make a story out of it without reflecting upon all the prejudices and blind spots that are in this perspective. And so you just reiterate the stereotypical worldviews, and especially if you are a media company that doesn't have so much money and so the people don't have so much time to really do a profound research, then you just end up by telling the same distorted narrative over and over again. And so without reflecting your reality tunnel and what that does to society. Yes.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah.
And it might be worth mentioning, too, that that infosphere itself sort of unfolds in an almost developmental sequence in a certain sense, in terms of what are the primary kinds of infrastructure or platforms that are sustaining a particular type of infosphere, right? So you and I talked about previously about how, for example, when we made this transition from sort of the cable TV era, right, which sustained a particular kind of mode of discourse, because most of the creators and the contributors that were inputting into the infosphere were largely orange stage and above. They were the creators. Yeah. Everyone else was sort of the consumers of that information. And then once we shifted from the cable era into the information age, and then again into the attention age or the social media age, that kind of changed the entire layout. It changed the infrastructure. It changed, you know, the perceptions of trust and legitimacy that we associate with all of these things. And, you know, as we've talked about before, one of the biggest things to impact that mode of discourse was exactly that, was the fact that now every human being has this shiny rectangle in their pocket that allows them to directly contribute to that mode of discourse, right? So there's no longer sort of, you know, the experts up here in the ivory tower that are kind of handing information down to us in a more centralized way. Now what we have is a decentralized, almost free-for-all. And the unfortunate part of that, it's liberating a lot of ways, but it's also oppressive in a lot of ways, because I think one of the things that we happened was, surprise, surprise, 70% of the world is pre-orange. So as a result, when everyone got a smartphone and everyone started sort of routing around a lot of these traditional media outlets, the mode of discourse kind of regressed, right? So now our average mode of discourse, at least here in the United States, you can tell me how it is for you over there in Germany, but the average mode of discourse has really dropped to, you know, what we've described previously as that debate mode, that sort of umber, you know, if not dictate mode, where ideological dictates, amber ideological dictates are really, you know, sort of defining the infosphere as we know it, to the point where it's like one ideology has one set of quote unquote facts, another ideology has another set of facts. No one can agree on any of those facts, right? Which of course means that they're not facts at all because they're not objectively consistent from context to context. So this is one of the big challenges that I think journalists, you know, all of these maps and models that we're making, I think all of them are always true, no matter what platform they're kind of, you know, this software is operating on. But it operates differently when you install it onto a new piece of hardware, right? Yes. These things work a little bit differently. The incentives change, the, you know, both the financial incentives, but also just sort of the desire for knowledge, the quest for knowledge. It changes as we go from classic media age, let's say print media, to television media, to cable, to the information age, which I insist only lasted a few years, right? The information age didn't last very long before it turned into the attention age and the social media age. And each one of those, I think, comes with a unique set of challenges, but also opportunities, tremendously liberating opportunities, like the fact that you and I can have this conversation right now. This wasn't possible 20 years ago. Not like this, anyway. So that's, you know, that's something that's become a bit of a recurring theme to me, is how the transition into the social media age actually dropped that mode of discourse. Because as Ken has described, our mode of discourse is basically a poker game, right? Yeah. Is it a red poker game? Is it a green poker game? Is it a turquoise poker game? Well, that is entirely dependent on who's sitting at the table. And right now, we have a lot more people sitting at the table who themselves are just simply not yet orange, right? They haven't hit that because that's just where the world is. And there's nothing wrong with that. People are allowed to be whatever developmental, you know, stage that, you know, they want to be. There's no pressure to like grow into future stages or anything like that. But, you know, we do notice sort of the impact that it has on the rest of the infosphere and then society at large. This is why I think we're seeing so much of the polarization and sort of ideologically driven, you know, debates and oftentimes denial of reality, oftentimes just straight up ideological gaslighting. All of that is made possible in the social media age when there wasn't as much room for that, even let's say 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on what you say. And I mean, if I remember correctly, so the last time we talked, you also said, like, you put it on a very simple example, which I like, was like, every average TikTok video would have more more attention and more power than, like, I don't know, like the whole Spiegel magazine in a week, because it's just so much faster, so much economical, so much. So, and that's what I mean. That's what I was analyzing here as well. And you are absolutely right. I think it's coming mainly from the lower right quadrant. Mm-hmm. So like the structures, and I mean, I can just recommend everyone to look at your context map that you did on this, which is really just so overwhelmingly great. Mm. So, I mean, if I come back to like my journalist perspective, because I've been a journalist for like 20 years now, what this does to my profession and for the influence of my profession is that it's actually shrinking. So if you wanted to do this as an animated picture, this journalism bubble would be actually shrinking. So we are becoming like a smaller and smaller drop in this information pool because of that. And still my whole model somehow is about, I mean, you said, yes, it's about media literacy, understanding these things. But I mean, the core question, since I'm still a journalist, is, okay, we are shrinking, but still let's try to do what we can do as journalists, right?
Well, this is how things evolve, right? It's not like journalism is going to just evolve in a vacuum. Like, it takes a little bit of pain. And I think maybe the diminishing legitimacy, perceived legitimacy around our journalistic, you know, institutions, that might create the right kind of pain, you know, that allows for new kinds of emergence to come through, that allows some of these, you know, journalistic institutions to actually kind of self-reflect and maybe transform a bit in order to meet the pressures of the era.
Yeah, I mean, if I put it in a journalistically dramatic way, you could say that like these fading big media brands like CNN or Der Spiegel in Germany. So, I mean, they are fading, but they are still there. And so, I mean, the, I guess the only chance we have somehow is to reinvent ourselves in a way that we are contributing more to this infosphere pool, or you could say this value meme cocktail, to sort of try to do a counterweight, like to facilitate more maturity in this infosphere pool, in a way, as long as we are still, let's say, some kind of beacons in this pool.